So, Mike, when we were developing this scenario, initially you were leaning towards option one of making the run for it because, boy, it's close. I'm curious, how much would that storm have to shift, be just a little bit further to the west, and why? Like, how do you judge that it's enough I can do it versus, yeah, it's just too close?
All right, so I fly Part 135. We have an ops spec and an ops manual that says we maintain 20 miles distance. So that's kind of like burned into my head. I have been closer than that 20 miles, and I have seen no problem. I have also seen it kick the butt out of the people in the air. So it's you're playing Russian roulette. And so the 20 miles, I know, can even 20 miles may not be a buffer. So as a result, if 20 miles sometimes isn't enough, then it's always the minimum I'm willing to allow that number. So the problem is 20 miles from what? From the lightning strike, from the center of the cell, from the heavy precip return, you know, you have all these choices. And the one thing, and this is one of the challenges of this scenario, we're not given what the pilot's looking at out the window. That's a huge amount of data. And that's one of the things that if all I'm looking at and making a decision on is this radar return, no go, not going to try it. I don't have the 20 miles. If I'm looking out the window, I have all kinds of other things I can see. I can see ripples on water. I can see dust blowing away from a gust front. I could even see microbursts. I have watched them from the air. So, you know, there's a lot of visual cues. But when you don't have visual cues, and again, even if you don't have anything saying that it's a violent thunderstorm with lots of outwash that looks like you can get a pass, if you charge in there and don't have that full 20 miles, you're taking a chance.
Yeah, also, you know, the reason I didn't take option one, even though I'd be relatively confident that you could arrive at the airport in time, is that I look at my responsibility as protecting the airplane on the ground as well in the air. And you've got a rapidly intensifying cell that's headed right for that airport. And it's like, hey, congratulations, you've landed successfully. Now you can watch the airplane get destroyed by hail. So I don't want any part of that.
Now, I know we have some option one folks at the table. So for someone who is going option one, they feel like it's enough. They're looking ahead. There's no rain falling. It's going to be under the edge of the anvil. But, you know, it looks like I can make the run free and clear. Why are you going to do it?
Yeah, I'd be inclined to go to option one. And, you know, this is one of those scenarios where there's just a lot of judgment involved here. So right now what I'm looking at is I have clear airspace. I'm heading up. There are thunderstorms headed my way. The next rad, we always know there's some latency in there, but that works both ways. For you to take the backside option, you've got to skirt in between those two cells, which is never really a good idea, right? So how accurate is that next rad? How wide is that valley in between those two cells is kind of a question. And I feel like if you go option one all the way up, you've got really good runways that you can bail out on all the way up. There's a runway every 15 miles or so. So if it starts to get a little squirrely, you can pick one of those runways. Even the military runway, yes, at Hill Air Force Base, that if it just gets uncomfortable for you, you dive into one of those runways. That's why I'd choose that option.
I'm sort of on the Richard campaign here. I think the same thing is that there are just so many options, and Ogden looks to me to be sort of my bailout option if I wanted to. I would just keep on trucking up to the north, and then I would see how far that thunderstorm was moving. And if it's an air mass thunderstorm, how fast is it moving? It may just be more or less stationary, even though it's building, so it's not going to move much. And then I worry about trying to squeeze between those two thunderstorms to the north and the south, and then I see the corner of the restricted area. I don't know whether it's active or not, so how close do I get to the other one? And to me, again, I always love pavement underneath me, and I see Salt Lake City, and I see Hill Air Force Base, and I see Ogden. All of those places to me are just really nice options.
Well, one thing we know for sure is these thunderstorms we're looking at on our next rad are not where the next rad says they are. We don't know if they're somewhere else. They may still be there, but chances are they're not. So I'm going to utilize another source of information. I'm going to talk to Salt Lake Approach Control. I know that Approach Control has real-time radar, so what they're seeing is going to be an accurate depiction of these storms. I may make a different decision based on what they tell me, But based on what I see here, I'm inclined to get the airplane on the ground. I don't want to be the meat in the thunderstorm Wasatch Mountain sandwich. I don't feel comfortable heading out to the west unless I felt that that storm to the northwest of us was weakening or smaller or in a different spot. That might be a good option if that storm wasn't there. But my plan would be to proceed up to Sky Park Airport, which is just a bit north of our current position, and land there. Yeah, the airplane might get blown over, Dave. That's a certainly a logical thing, but I'm going to live through it real nice, unless it blows down the terminal building as well.
I'm looking at this, and my first inclination is to go to South Valley. It's almost under the wing there. It is close to that southern cell. And so Mike actually alluded to this earlier, that we're looking at the NAXRAD display in the cockpit for general information, but primarily we need to see what's available outside of the aircraft. If I'm seeing any indication of gust fronts, blowing dust, that sort of thing, then or that greenish tint that you often get in a storm cell that has hail falling through it, then I might think otherwise. But as long as it looks like the forward edge of the effects of that storm cell aren't going to hit the South Valley Airport before I could get the airplane on the ground, I look at that. I am very concerned about, you know, my responsibility to take care of the airplane. From the scenario, I don't know if it's going to be hangared if I would to make it back to its original destination. So exposure to hail may be an even chance either way. I don't know. I'm going to try to get the airplane on the ground there at South Valley unless I have visual indications that it's getting too close. Otherwise, I'm inclined to hit one of the options up the east side of the Great Salt Lake.
You know, this situation strikes me as a lot more dicey than it appears at first blush. And, you know, those are excellent points about, you know, going between two thunderstorms. That is never a comfortable thing to do. And this airplane, a DA-40, this thing is based on a glider. I mean, flying a DA-40 in turbulence or in the vicinity of thunderstorms, you know, at the very best, it is a hellacious spanking. And you know, you'll be watching those wings flex up and down, and it will not be a comfortable time at all. And I really like Wally's idea of getting the most current information from the controllers in real time. I think that's an excellent point.
You know, I think the one of the challenges of this scenario is the whole scenario is really based on what we're seeing on radar. And if I'm really flying this, the whole scenario is based on what I'm looking out the window. To be honest, those returns give me a chance to put two fingers on the iPad and see how many miles that is. Which is, again, like I said, it's drilled into me. I need 40 miles between cells before I split the cells. I need 20 miles distance from it, but I also know that's 15 minutes old. Whereas what I'm looking out the window is what I am flying into. And having seen some of these storms like this, it's pretty black. It's a dark, ugly-looking maw, and you know, that inclination to get on the ground. And to be honest, actually, I probably would be continuing. Bountiful Sky Park is a reasonable place. You have a little more time to get there and get tied down. South Valley is right there, but you're so much closer. So, you know, Richard McSpadden's idea of moving on and taking some of these other options. You know, we have to limit some of these options for the sake of gaming this, but at the same time, further heading that direction buys you more time to get to the tie downs and protect your aircraft.
Yeah, again, looking at the NAXRAD picture, really, because of the need to, we've been alluding to the separation from the storm cells by 20 miles or so by talking about being east, but there's that one gap. And the option of taking that gap across the lake and around the backside, it doesn't satisfy the 20-mile rule. So it's a non-starter to try to go across the lake if this was the only information we had to work with.
So I have a question for the group here. So Wally, you mentioned that you'd call ATC and ask them for an update because they have more real-time weather. But all they can see is precipitation, right?
Correct.
So while it's more real time, it may not be as broad or as inclusive as you'd like to know about the storm ahead of you. Is that right? Would you agree with that?
Well, I think they'll give me a level of precipitation that they're seeing, which is indicative of the intensity of the storm. Yeah. They're going to say a level 4, level 5. So I think that's useful information.
Oh, definitely useful. What I'm worried about is I may be worried about more than just the precipitation, right? I may be worried more about the outstretch of that, where the gusty winds are going to come into a factor, and where you're absolutely right. Severe turbulence and all that, which they're not going to know that.
You're absolutely right, and that's where Mike's 20-mile distance, I think, is a good number, because it's not a guarantee you won't have some of that stuff, but certainly anywhere near a thunderstorm, you could have that.
Dr. David Strahle is considered to be the father of weather data uplinks in the cockpit. I've heard him speak many times. And at Oshkosh about 3 years ago, he made a presentation, and it made perfect sense to me, talking about that separation from radar returns. And he said that what we're trying to avoid, of course, is not the precipitation itself, but the turbulence associated with it. And that a thunderstorm has three phases or three parts of its life: the cumulus or updraft stage, the mature stage when precipitation begins to fall, and then the dissipation stage. And although the direction of the air currents, the vertical air currents, is different in each one of the stages, each one of those is by definition hazardous to light airplanes. And so his point, without going into his entire presentation, is that if a storm cell is intense enough that it has yellow or red returns, and it's a cumulus-based cell, if it's a storm cell that's intense enough that it has red or yellow returns, that even the green areas of precipitation are still in an area with enough turbulence that it needs to be avoided, and that the avoidance is not from the center of the storm cell, but from the closest green precipitation associated with that complex. So at this point, there's almost nowhere on this entire map that is really safe from the potential turbulence effects of this building storm system.
One of the things here that we've been talking about is the next rad return versus like what we see with our eyes. And there are two things that come to mind here. One is this sort of siren song of technology. It's like the next rad return is so colorful and useful of information. It's hard not to like make that the center of what I'm doing and toss that aside and look outside into the murk, right? But okay, once I've done that, what am I really looking for out there specifically that is going to give me enough information to make the call with enough time to land and get the airplane safe? Like, there's a long latency between making the decision to bail, as you were saying, Richard, and when I'm actually tied down on a ramp. It's not, you know, 2 or 3 minutes. And a storm could move quite a bit and conditions could change quite a bit in the amount of time it actually takes me even directly below to land.
You know, there's a couple other things here too, which is, do you know the airport you're bailing out on? If you do, then you can get to the tie downs quicker. So your familiarity with the airports and the vicinity, this pilot is from this area, so there's a good chance they've been at these airports, know where the tie downs are. That's helpful. If you are just a transient pilot passing through, you don't have that. So you're going to spend a lot more time on the ground. You know, the other thing, there's two things we haven't really talked about. One is Salt Lake, as a Class Bravo airport, has two modalities, basically, landing north and landing south. So one of big important question is, which way are they landing right now? Because that, and then the other thing is, you should be listening on, or you should be probably on approach control. You're going to be getting lots of auditory feedback of, where are the jets going? Where are the other planes? Because there's always going to be planes out here. There's going to be lots of information to give you situational awareness about wind shear, about winds on the ground. You can ask the controller, tell me about the winds at Ogden. You could tune it in, but you can ask a controller. They have that information there. You might be getting bumped around in the cockpit, particularly in a DA-40, if you're in the turbulence, where you might not be able to dial in a frequency because of turbulence. And being able to ask the controllers to help fill in your situational awareness is a huge benefit that you have in Class Bravo.
Well, they might be also, you know, when you're really busy, they're really busy too. You know, the controllers at Salt Lake are going to be working hard here. About the last thing that they may want is to talk to you when they're diverting a bunch of airliners around a bunch of air mass thunderstorms. So, you know, you've got that kind of conflict too, trying to bust in on that frequency if you're not already talking to them.
Maybe that's that Utah courtesy, but I've found them to be very helpful. They know that you're in a bind and they're going to be there to help you too. So while I agree, you are an inconvenience as a slow airplane out there mixing it up. And yeah, their workload's high, But your self-interest is their interest as well. They don't want to send you into a storm. They're going to be understanding, maybe not as understanding of your situation if you're a low-time pilot or the nature of your aircraft or how bouncy it is. They can't see that. But you give them a little bit of information about what's going on in the cockpit and what you're seeing, they'll be really helpful getting you through that restricted area, for example.
Do people treat air mass thunderstorms differently than frontal line thunderstorms in terms of avoidance? And if so, you know, what's the difference there? How do you kind of wrap your brain around your strategy?
Well, there is a big difference between the two, for sure. I mean, the kind of storms that Tom has out there in Kansas that are coming through with a cold front pushing them through typically are a much more solid line. They just come marching through, and there's virtually, with the equipment we have, without radar, it's almost impossible to penetrate that line because it's thick. The air mass storms kind of come and go. They build, and then they dissipate. It'd be very not uncommon for a storm like we're looking at here to build up, shut off the sun, and that's its generator, dump its water, cool the air around it, and in 30 or 40 minutes be gone. But we don't exactly know what these storms are doing, whether they're building or dissipating, as Tom said.
Yeah, I'm the same way. If I'm getting chased by a cold front and the thunderstorm's moving at 40 knots, it's a lot different than if it's just an air mass thunderstorm that's just kind of sitting out there, and I'm more confident to pick my way through and around those storms as I am trying to get through a front.
In a DA-40, I don't want any part of either type.
I feel like I have to defend the DA-40 a little bit, which is, you know, as a near and dear to my heart. It does bounce around quite a bit, but man, can that thing handle a crosswind landing? Like,
it's a wonderful airplane.
Believe.
It's super efficient. Yeah. Just don't put it in turbulence. That's not where it wants to be.
Oh, well, back to your question, I think that avoidance doesn't change, whether it's an air mass thunderstorm or a steady state thunderstorm associated with a front or anything else. The rules of avoidance don't change at all. It's easier to avoid the air mass thunderstorm because they tend to be isolated, and as Wally said, they come and go fairly rapidly. So that makes it easier to deal with them, but both types of thunderstorms from a hazard avoidance standpoint are identical.
But I'd rather be parked on the backside than on the front.
Yeah, that's definitely true. You know, I've definitely worked with students in my own where I talk about thunderstorms. I'm saying you wouldn't run in front of a freight train. You'd wait for it to go past. So let's jump behind the freight train instead. It's definitely true. And I think, as came up a little earlier, the next rad is hard to ignore and put aside and use the most valuable tool you have in thunderstorm avoidance, which are your eyeballs looking out the front of the airplane, supplemented by all the other tools that you have, and realizing that you need enough space and time. So not just 20 miles distance, but maybe 10 minutes temporally from when a storm is going to be there in order to do the things that you need to do to keep yourself safe and keep options open without things closing in around you and leaving you nowhere to go.